Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Crispin Moore.
All right. On tonight's show, we're going to take a look at the most successful campaign on Kickstarter, Apple's move away from Google Maps, Yahoo's next move after ResumeGate, and new changes at Facebook, and whether they're enough to keep advertisers interested. So how you guys doing this week?
Pretty well.
Yeah, I'm trying to survive Internet Week in New York. It's a big thing.
What is Internet Week?
It's like, it started a couple years ago, I think like 5 years ago, as a way to like rally New York's tech scene. Mm-hmm. And now that there actually is a tech scene, it's actually become kind of a big deal. So there are all these startups and events happening and panels. I just did a panel tonight.
Is that like Fashion Week? Like the Fashion Week for the tech world?
Yeah,
I guess it could be like that. Yeah, because there are celebrities involved. There are, you know, the big CEOs. Mayor Bloomberg was here on a...
Ugh.
Because he's here for any event happening in New York.
Because he's a... Ugh.
Yeah. So,
don't hold it back.
It's interesting. It's nice to see the city rallying behind tech. I'm trying to bring Dwayne back so he can actually take part in all this joy that's happening here.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We're looking at that plan to get back there.
All right. Let's get into some of these headlines, barring any. I'm assuming no one's played with anything this last week.
I bought the most mundane piece of tech.
Did you?
Possibly buy.
What is it?
I got a shredder.
A shredder. You know what? I'm going to have some interesting things to talk about on next week's show as far as what we've been playing with. Hopefully. I'm crossing my fingers. I don't want to say it right now. I'll say it next week when I've already experienced it.
Guys, I want to guess at this because, you know, he just got the MacBook Air.
Yeah.
He has a MacBook. He has a
MacBook. You will never guess.
They're not updating. He just got the new iPad 3. What could Andy have possibly purchase?
You'll never guess.
Andy will finally get an Xbox. That's
what it is. Wait, are we saying that none of us have played Diablo yet? We are old geeks.
I have not.
I've been trying to, but Blizzard won't let me, so...
I've never played any of the Diablo games, so I don't even know. What? I'm not even into that franchise.
Stay a while and listen.
I fell for the hype. I bought it yesterday. I have not been able to log in.
Oh, man.
So, thanks a lot.
I heard servers were down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I had a preview, and I was too stupid to not play it, so my coworker played it, and he said, I think... I'm not going to be able to get married at the end of this year because this game is taking my life away.
No, we'd like the wife to play Diablo 3. That's the only choice. But Dwayne, you know what? The shredder isn't that mundane. There is actually a choice people have to make. Always get the crosscut shredder. Always.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
As opposed to...
But then the thing is a problem. Okay, what we're playing with. I bought a Fellows shredder. It's a crosscut. It's some ridiculous model. Hold on. I'll just read what the model is.
It's the diamond cut.
The W11C. And, you know, I'm looking at a shredder. And what do you think when you think about a shredder? The same thing you think about, like, a toaster oven or some other mundane tech. You're like, okay, I know how much I want to spend. Let me see if I can find what I want. Then you spend the next 2 hours on a Sunday looking at every single thing out there. And you realize that what you want to spend isn't going to cover what you actually want. Because there are a lot of, like, technological and other, like, you know, just basic – they're feature sets that you know, stand above, you know, the standard. And you want above the standard because, you know, if you buy the cheapest one, it's not going to last. You're not going to be happy with it. It'll get stuck on some credit card one day and you're going to curse yourself and you're going to spend all this time. So then you end up spending another half hour just figuring out between the ones that like are at the peak of what you'd possibly be willing to spend. What's different between them and the ones at what you will not spend. And you end up buying what you will not spend. And that was my drama with my shredder this week. That's like what happens. It's mundane tech. It's not like it's not Wi-Fi connected, right? I can't like do anything, like not yet at least. So I'm looking at it and I know, you know, like, okay, this is just one of those things you have to get. But at the same time, you're like, okay, well, what am I actually getting? And then, you know, it just kind of goes into that diligence role that all geeks end up at. But for me, like if I can't put it on GDGT, I'm less excited about it.
I have not used GDGT to its full exploited to its full advantage.
Indeed, they need a great app to tap into that database, because that's what I really want. The website is nice, but it's never where I need it. You know,
I think that's the problem that I'm experiencing. Mm-hmm. Also, let's get into some of these headlines here. So last week we talked about Scott Thompson, Yahoo's CEO, getting caught up in essentially lying about a job on his resume. I'm sorry, lying about education on his resume, and Yahoo kind of being painted into a corner as to what to do with him. Well, that answer has been answered this week, and the Yahoo board of directors have named Fred Amoroso as chairman of the board of directors, and Ross Levinson as interim CEO, replacing Scott Thompson. In addition to the management upheaval, Yahoo's board is closing in on a settlement with the man who discovered Scott Thompson's misstep, activist shareholder Daniel Loeb of Third Point. Amoroso is the director who's been conducting the investigation into the issues raised by Loeb about how the fake academic credentials got in Thompson's public bios, as well as Yahoo's regulatory filings. So there we go. That's kind of the bottom line. I had a feeling that this wasn't just going to get, you know, swept under the rug, that Scott was going to have to pay big for this.
Yeah, so there you go. I saw a great tweet about that. Somebody posted something so Yahoo bought, you know, got something off eBay that wasn't exactly what it said on the packaging. Not really a little bit of irony there.
Very nice. Well done. Yeah. Golf clap.
Yeah.
Okay, so in other news here, if you thought the campaign for the Pebble e-paper watch would show signs of slowing after it broke Kickstarter records and pushed past $5 million in pledges, you'd be wrong, for it has now topped $10 million in pledges, and they've sold out of all available watches.
Yeah, all the Gen 1 devices are gone. Yeah. Glad I got my hands on one.
Yeah,
me
too.
Hands on one too. But that is to say, like, as much as – because my coworkers, he's like a fellow tech guy. He's like, yeah, I don't need this. I'll look at it later. And I'm like, dude, it's gone. He's like, what do you mean it's gone? Oh, no. The bad news about that, yeah, it's gone if you want it. But the good news is that, like, it's so successful, you know, there's going to be a version 2. And if Pebble's going to do anything like, I mean, I think this is their second product, but if they're anything like, you know, so many other tech companies, that V2 is going to have all the stuff you really want. So, I mean, I'm just so happy that this little company could get its start, do well enough to really get supported and go forward.
Yeah, they found a very important thing, which I think we've talked about before, relating to hardware, which is that via Kickstarter, hardware companies can actually validate that there's a market for their ideas before they spend a ton of time building it. You know, like, it's not that hard these days to build, like, a good demo of a product. I mean, obviously it takes a lot more effort than building software, but it's not, you know, the hardest thing. The real problem is, you know, actually figuring out how to take your initial, you know, bag of wires that you threw together and actually make it, you know, a manufactured product that people can have. And that requires not just convincing, you know, like, users to buy it. It also means convincing investors and convincing, like, people in the supply and production business that there's actually going to be demand for this and you're going to actually pay for your orders and everything. And, like,
you're gonna
Kickstarter
your inventory, yeah. Like, you can sell out of inventory.
And Kickstarter is just like the perfect pitch for anyone, any angel or VC who wants to go into hardware. You know, they can just be like, look, we have 80,000 people on Kickstarter who have paid us or who will pay us money for this. But it's even better than that, because they don't even actually have to raise an initial seed round. They can actually just use the money off of Kickstarter as their seed round and then just go straight to a venture capital round without having to giving up any equity. It's absolutely spectacular. Yeah,
because here's the thing. This happens in real estate all the time. You build a high-rise condo in New York, or even like an office building. You don't begin construction until you have people who've already agreed to sign, right? And they do exactly what happens on Kickstarter. They say, I'm going to buy that condo for $900,000. I know the market price is going to be $1 million, but I'm going to save $100,000 because I'm signing up early. And thereafter, once they hit that certain cap of people, once they hit that number, in this case, the Kickstarter, like, minimum, whatever, their goal – Then after that, it's not quite gravy, but it's exactly what you need to determine what it is you can build, right? Like what the amenities are going to be, what kind of materials you're going to use, whatever. And I think that's what this is. That's what they're doing. They've adapted the model in a great way to toys, right? We want these toys. We want these toys, and they're taking a look at who wants the toys and who's willing to pay for the toys. And it's literally a case of putting your money where your mouth is, and boom, there you go.
The two things I wanted to say about this that I love about this is, it's first of all, it's totally kind of disrupting the model of startups, where instead of forming a startup and asking for capital, you can just throw a one shot out there on Kickstarter. If it fails, you're not out very much. If you succeed, if you hit that right, you know, that target market, that could be the foundation for your new startup. And the second thing is that I love how in this particular case with the Pebble, how as pledges started to come in and they started to reach their goal, corporate partners started to jump on to the bandwagon and want to get involved with Pebble. And so, you know, for the investor, that's like a value added extra. You know, it's like not only do you have the thing that you initially pledged your money to, but now you're getting extra value from these corporate partners that are wanting to have lumped themselves into this Kickstarter project.
Yeah.
So let's move on here.
Apple's coming out with the Map app.
Yes. Apple is going to be replacing their standard map, which utilizes Google Maps, with their own new map technology. And we talked about this technology before on the show. This is the thing that they did, where they basically purchased this company called C3 Technologies. And I believe they're the one that do the flyover. They do flyover in jets, like in two or three passes, and get this really dynamic 3D kind of perspective. And then they map it onto, like, one of the passes is just a terrain pass, where they get just the data points of the terrain. And then they map the image onto the terrain pass, and you get this really dynamic 3D. It's kind of like what Google does, but they have people manually doing with the building models of the buildings for the maps. Mm-hmm. This company does it all in like three or four passes automatically.
Right. And the big thing here is that Apple has always coded the Map app, but this is just a question of like what's going to happen on the back end. In 2007, Google had the best map solution out there. Apple licensed the software, licensed the back end, licensed the ability to use the copyrighted Google Maps, and put that in their app, which they had no bones about. It says it's got all the Google imagery, it's got all that stuff, but Apple actually writes the application, which is why it doesn't get updated the way, like, for instance, a separate Google application will get updated. So it's going to be interesting once Apple gets out of their agreement and utilizes their own back end for this C3 technology you're talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's going to be interesting is whether or not Google drops their own app in the App Store that competes with the Apple one, the way MapQuest has done. And MapQuest app is actually, despite the fact that no one really uses MapQuest online on the web, their app is quite good, especially if you're a person who has to spend any time in a car, because it does give you turn-by-turn directions for free, and it does it, you know, it's done right with the API, so your music can play. It'll, like, slow your music down, tell you, you know, that the turn is coming up X amount of meters away or feet away or whatever, yards, and then, hey, get ready to turn now, all that stuff, and it's pretty seamless. So there's a lot of room for Google to get in here and also hop in there and also, like, say what they have to say, because they have turn-by-turn navigation on all their Android devices, and you know, if they want to get in that fight, they're in a good position too.
Yeah, I don't know though. Like, they could have easily released like a Google navigation separate app. Mm-hmm. Over the past couple years on iOS. So,
do you think so? What's their deal? Because the deal might have been like, hey, we're going to build the right. Map app with your stuff. You can't build an app. So I don't know what the deal is.
Yeah, maybe that was it. It's kind of unclear. The bigger problem though is like Google could totally make a competing app if Apple changes. But it'll never be the default. And that's kind of the killer with iOS, right? Like, no matter how many competitors there are, when you click a link in an email, you're going to end up at Apple's thing. And
they have to open those APIs for other
apps. Yeah, I don't think
that's the one thing I miss most about Android is the ability to be like, you know, I have a custom handler for sharing tweets and a custom handler for sharing emails.
Default
and a
browser, custom how about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Default browser choice.
Really nice because, like, you know, I just don't necessarily want everything that Apple wants. And, you know, they do a good job with a lot of it, but I want to be able to change it up. And that's, I have to admit, that's the one thing I miss most.
For stability, I guess, in iOS, like, that's really what it comes down to. Like, Chris, you jumped from Android because it was kind of a mess.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that on the flip side, when I click on a link, it all opens.
You have battery life all day.
Yeah, which more than makes up for it as a trade-off. That being said, I wish I didn't have to make that trade-off, I guess is what it really goes down to.
Yeah.
You know, one other thing I would wonder, honestly, Maps does not seem to be something where Google is necessarily putting a huge amount of their engineering muscle at the moment. It was nice to see somebody innovating here. Like, unfortunately, one problem we have is that, you know, Google will do something super innovative and pretty much come to dominate the market. Mm-hmm. And unless there's a reason
what makes you
for
say
them.
That, Chris? What makes you say that they're not innovating on maps? I feel like they're innovating on the maps online. They've got the car that's using the maps. They just
the maps. But I mean, what have they done new about maps in the last 3 years?
Besides they just the 3D, the way the Street View is. Like, they've done work on maps. Maps has been
they've been collecting a huge amount of data. I don't know.
They've been doing resolution. I mean, I think it's incremental progress. It's not some game changing progress. So, I mean, the Apple paradigm shift is obviously very different. But I think Google
still is doing some very exciting things on the map side.
You know, I think this is the future of like Google likes to combine their technologies, and I think the automated cars, the auto cars, are just going to be able to produce that much more frequent updates for Google Maps.
Yeah.
Have you seen Maps GL, where you can take 3D photo tours of landmarks, view 3D buildings, fly over 45 degree aerial view images, swoop quickly into Street View without a plug-in?
It's one
of their beta things. It's there now. If you go to maps.google.com, it's sort of their big new initiative.
I'm thinking one of the reasons why I might not be seeing this is because my main work computer doesn't have a 3D acceleration on the video card. So all these OpenGL things that are going out right now, I don't even see. The browser's just like, I'm not even going to give it to you because I don't have that. I realized that as I was doing some test coding and everything. So yeah, no, I take that back. If they are doing stuff and it has to do with like OpenGL and whatnot, I'm just never going to see it on this computer.
Gotcha.
Continuing on with the Apple talk, the new iPhone that Apple is expected to unveil this year is likely to have a larger display than its current models have, according to the Wall Street Journal, who is rarely ever wrong about stuff like this. With the company ordering bigger screens from its Asian suppliers, the ever-popular people familiar with the matter said, the new screens measure at least 4 inches diagonally, the people said, compared with 3.5 inches on Apple's latest model. Production is set to begin next month. Analysts have predicted the next iPhone will come out in the fall. So 3.5 to 4 inches, it's not revolutionary, but it's definitely, I think, a move that Apple needed to make at this point after all of the other smartphones have since increased their size.
Yeah, this is definitely something we've been hearing about for a while. And I think it's no surprise that a lot of the features we see in new iPhones come from people kind of like loving the idea of something, guessing it, and Apple taking a couple years to implement it. definitely excited to see what they do. Always a little worried about pixel density being lost. Now, you know, if the Retina goes from, 326 DPI to 320 DPI, I'm sure that's not going to be an issue.
Even if it goes to, 300, like, you can still get pretty close up there.
Yeah.
I think the new iPad's display is so good that I don't think Apple's going to have trouble finding a supplier to do it at 4 inches, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that it's going to be – I mean, I'm excited to see what they want to do. This is definitely, the top sort of, phone. I'm surprised that – the analysts are really focused on the idea that it's coming out in the fall. I mean, I'm not only surprised because I'm surprised that someone's willing to say that. It seems to make sense. I'm just surprised that someone's willing to like put themselves out there, even though they remain unnamed, so I guess they're not really putting themselves out
right.
there.
I don't know. Everyone's been saying that because of last year, so...
Yeah. And it also makes sense for like, the Christmas market. The Christmas market is exactly what it comes down to, you know?
It makes sense for that, and also it does not make sense for Apple to like kill the iPhone 4S's lifespan. Like, you have to give their device like at least a year.
Right.
You know, the iPhone 4 had more than a year, but I can't see them actually, you know, killing off that brand so early.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be kind of ridiculous to do.
Yeah.
The only reason, I could see them doing it if the design was so fresh and so new. Not unlike the Verizon iPhone, right? The Verizon iPhone 4 came out and, you know, it was on the market from like February 2011 to October 2011. So it technically had a shorter lifespan. It had 8-month lifespan. So that's the only reason why I would see them doing it early. But I think your point is valid.
It could also be that fall is a better time for a purchase like this too, just from what I'm thinking. Like, the games industry doesn't really have too many big releases over the summer because, you know, people are out doing stuff. They're not home playing games. It's tough to come up with the same sort of, what the hell is that? Sorry.
This sounds like an alien is coming into your house.
That's the cops trying to solve crime in my neighborhood with loud noises. But it's tough to compare, you know, the games industry and the cell phone industry, but you know, when you hit the fall, you get the holiday season, you get a lot of things. Kids are just going back to school. It could be a better time for people to just buy a big product like that.
Moving on here, continuing with more Apple news here. Apple's preparing a new lineup of thinner MacBook laptops running on more powerful chips. People with knowledge of the plans said, "I love how they coach that that phrase so they keep it vague enough." The MacBook Pro machines to be unveiled at Apple's annual developers conference starting June 11th will also feature high definition screens, so Retina displays like those in the iPhone and the iPad, as well as flash memory to cut startup times and extend battery life. The people who asked not to be identified because the plans haven't been made public.
So here's my thing about this. Yeah. The thing that's keeping me from a MacBook Air, because I don't want two things. One, I don't want a computer that's my second computer. I want a computer that's my only computer, with the exception of like a server. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. There's Wayne being stubborn again.
I know.
MacBook Air is that to me.
I would say that for me, like, I want it to be that, except for the disk space. So what I'm saying is, I'd like to see, like, if there's going to be a 15-inch MacBook Pro with an Air-type profile, I want to be able to have an SSD in it. Like, some of the Wintel machines that we've seen that are, like, Sleekbooks or Ultrabooks or whatever, they manage to somehow fit an SSD in there, a standard-size SSD, 2.5-inch SSD in there. And to me, that's a big deal because... right now I'm in a laptop that I really like, but you know, the hard drive is getting a bit cramped. I'm going to be able to take that hard drive out, pop it into a dock with another hard drive, have everything copied over into the bigger one, and then pop that new hard drive in.
You know what, Dwayne?
I feel like that's something for me.
I'm going to say one thing here.
I want that functionality.
I think you know, two or three years ago, when I would have a laptop, I had the same concerns about storage space. But ever since I got this MacBook Air, and I've got the 250 gig MacBook Air, and ever since basically the advent of cloud storage, I don't really use that much.
Though, and I'm not always connected. That's my issue. Like, when I have my laptop on the plane, I want to be able to. I don't want to have to think about
how many songs are you going
to
go through in one plane flight.
That's the whole point. Like, this is my.
I think that is sort of the point, though, Dwayne. Like, the use case. When you have your computer, right, and you have no connectivity at all. I mean, even with an SSD, you can fit a couple hours worth of music, but you want everything.
Well, it's like, it's also like, for instance, iTunes Match is not working for me.
Right.
It's not a viable solution for me. Like, I bought it and I thought that there's some functionality there, but it doesn't behave as smartly as I would like it to. So it doesn't do certain things. Like, it doesn't understand what's an audiobook and what's not. It doesn't understand some other things like that, unless I guess I purchased that audiobook from the app store, from the music store. So for me, you know, I just kind of want my main machine to be exactly as I want it. And I think if I'm going to pay $2,000 for an i7 Ivy Bridge, it's got to have that. And I also want 8 gigs in my computer.
You know, I don't.
What do you mean,
I'm not
eight
saying,
gigs? Oh, RAM.
Yeah, I need 8 gigs. I use 8 gigs of RAM in all my computers.
That is one thing that really could hurt because, like,
yeah.
I don't know if it's just Chrome or if it's a change
Chrome.
In the way the web developing is happening, but like, I am running out of RAM all the time at 4 gigs.
Yeah, it's Chrome. Like, so like. For me, Chrome is using a lot of space. And the thing is, I do a lot of research on my computer. I when I get to work, I put my computer down. I have 4 screens attached to it. 3 screens attached to it. And I'm doing research on all sorts of things. And I have, like, I can at any given time have, like, 80 to 120 tabs open. I mean, they get closed by the end of the day, whatever. But as I do my research, I'll do some searches on Google or Lexis or whatever, and I'll do like the right click, open a new tab, things like that. And you know, I do a lot of reading, and I gotta say that I don't want to be. I like the sleek factor. I like you know the OS X. I just don't want to feel like I'm limited in any capacity, and that's what I'm worried about with.
Well, Dwayne, in that case, I would recommend that you go with the computer that I had when I was working at LinkedIn. It was had 40 gigabytes of RAM. And a quad core processor that should about hit what you need.
You need a Cray supercomputer.
But it has to be a laptop. Honestly, the MacBook Air, even the current one, can probably keep up with your web browsing habits, Dwayne. So
yeah. I can say, really? I feel like I need at least. Here's my thing.
Overload mine. Yeah,
I can live at 500 gigs of storage. I don't want to. I can live with that. That's fine. I'm a storage hog. I have a lot of shit on my computer. I get it. That's what it is. I just don't want to feel like I have to connect to something every time I want a file that's like disparate and obscure.
Mm-hmm.
I think other geeks understand that. Like we're in 2012 at this point. Like I just feel like I shouldn't have to have that kind of compromise anymore.
Yeah, I don't see it as a compromise. I see it as like an evolution. Right. It used to be that we were so concerned about like getting more hard drive space and like because we needed to archive our media, we need to burn CDRs, we need to like to make backups. But in a way, like we've come to like a zen point, right, where things are getting simpler.
Yeah,
at least for me, like I'm trying to simplify my tech life because I just have way too much data and I just can't deal with it.
Well, so that's what I've done. So I have storage that's external. I have like a server machine and I can access that and things like that when I need to. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to just like the random entertainment stuff, there are times when I want to listen to like some random film score because I'm at work and it's like appropriate for that. I just don't want to have to think about it.
And that's you have situation. No internet connectivity? That's what I'm saying. Like, do you want to? How often are you on a plane or without internet? And you want to hit
it's
that?
It's not just that. It's just the idea that I'm going to have to use my work's network to connect to iTunes Max, which I think is not. It doesn't work for me the way I'd like it to work. I don't find that.
iTunes Match I've heard not so great things about. But RDO is free now. Spotify is pretty great.
Or you could upload everything to Google Music. Google
yes.
Music has an awesome experience.
Yeah, okay. I'm looking into Google Music. Spotify.
Wait, I recommended a Google service to you.
Yes.
I know.
I do like Google.
Google Music is powerful.
Yeah.
Spotify, like, okay, my music collection is, and I'm a weirdo. I get it. I'm like, I'm a Joss Whedon fan. Not everyone, like, you know, I like stuff that's like not.
I don't think that makes you an outlier.
Yeah, there are quite a few Joss Whedon fans.
There are, but what I'm saying is that he doesn't write for the masses. He writes for like his peeps. He even wrote the Geeks of Doom. And what I'm saying is for me, like, I have random. Like shit that just isn't on Spotify.
Yeah.
When I want to make a genius playlist on like iTunes, more often than not, it says there's no way
you
we can make
a genius. I think we've talked about this on the show before, though. Like Spotify is great for like 75% of my music, and then everything else I just dump on Google, like Google Music. And there's like a semi decent iOS app for Google Music. It's fine. It works with AirPlay. Yeah. And like that, I found gets me access to pretty much all the obscure crap I could want. But yes, you do need an internet connection. I don't know; it hasn't been too big of a problem for me.
Dwayne, I would honestly put like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I just don't have as big a music collection as everyone else. I think my music collection is like maybe 25 gigs or something.
Dwayne is also a pack rat. Let's make this clear.
Yeah,
he wants everything.
But if you are a pack rat, I mean, so my experience doing like. IT, and granted, this was like 4 or 5 years ago at this point. My experience with laptops when I was doing help desk is you can't count on a laptop hard drive. Like,
yeah.
You just simply can't count on it. Like,
well,
you
I back
need
the thing
to...
up. The thing is backed up. Like, it's.
But
know,
like, backup should
it.
Be
yeah,
like but like your backup shouldn't just be like, oh, I got to restore the entire thing. Like, it honestly makes more sense that everything that's important to you in some place where it's like actually durable, and you don't even have to back it up. It's just there.
Maybe. I mean, here's the thing. I have, like, you know, obviously I have my music in two places. I have it on my laptop. I have it on my server, and my server is the iTunes Match computer, things like that. I found when I use my laptop with iTunes Match, it just didn't work. So I was like, okay, fine. Now, I prefer iTunes when it comes to finding whatever music. So I put my music back on, like, a laptop, and that's why I have it in two places. When it comes to things like the documents and things like that, those are all sitting on Dropbox. I'm not worried about them. Hard drive can go away, whatever. And the music is elsewhere. So that what I need is right there all the time. But I just feel like I don't want to have to – I guess I want to think about things. Or I'm out and I'm like visiting home and somebody's like, oh, do you have that album? Or, oh, do you have whatever? And I'm like, okay, let me go find like a You Send It link, or I don't know. Like, instead of just being able to pop in a thumb drive, pass it over to them, or like just, you know, send it via like Trillion or something.
And I think, Dwayne, you should try embracing some of these cloud services, because all the examples
I use cloud services is what I'm saying. Like, I use Dropbox. Yeah. I have Box.net.
No. I'm talking about things like Spotify. I'm talking about things that give you instant access to this media.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan.
Like, just try it, because all the use cases you're bringing up, aside from being stuck on the plane, when you could just listen to, like, you know, something else, like your iPhone, your actual music player, I don't know. Yeah. Spotify does it all for me, and generally everywhere you go, you know, people have Wi-Fi, so
more or less. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on. Sorry to eat that.
It's okay.
This is us trying to like whack Dwayne's traditional, I don't know. It's not Luddite. It's just like,
no, he has got very specific case uses, use cases. Okay. So moving on here, there was an article this week in at Gizmodo, written by Matt Honan, called "How Yahoo Killed Flickr and Lost the Internet," and I thought this is a fascinating article. I don't know if anybody had a chance to read it, but it's essentially a case study of what can go wrong when a nimble, innovative startup gets gobbled up by a behemoth that doesn't share its values. What happened to Flickr? The same thing that happened to so many other nimble, innovative startups who sold out for dollars and bandwidth. Yahoo. So he goes into the core idea in this article that he talks about. I'm going to read a little quote here. He says, "It was a stunning failure in vision. All Yahoo cared about was the database its users had built and tagged. It didn't care about the community that had created it, or more importantly, continuing to grow that community by introducing new features." And there's a quote from one high-ranking Yahoo executive who said, "That's the reason we bought Flickr, not the community. We didn't give a shit about that. The theory behind buying Flickr was not to increase social connections. It was to monetize the image index. It was totally not about social communities or social networking. It was certainly nothing to do with the users." And that was the problem. At the time, the web was rapidly becoming more social, and Flickr was at the forefront of that movement. It was all about groups and comments and identifying people as contacts, friends, and families. To Yahoo, it was just a fucking database.
What did they intend to do with it? They haven't actually monetized the database, to my knowledge, unless they're somehow...
Well, like, part of the article goes into that, is that basically Yahoo is behind the curve on any of these potentials that they could have had, like getting an entire site-wide integration of all Yahoo members into Flickr. They failed at that. They failed at getting Flickr on mobile the way they should have. And basically they let Facebook and Instagram roll over them, which is a shame, because I still love Flickr and I still believe in Flickr. I have a flicker of hope for Flickr. So it's just a real shame.
I don't have a flicker of hope anymore. I don't know. I used to, I think it was even back when DaVinci and I were working together, we referred to Yahoo as the place where promising startups go to die.
Yes.
Like, it's just
yes.
You know, it's just like this sad graveyard for super promising startups. And, you know, it's hard to fault them for selling, you know, especially if it's a good price, and especially the early ones like Facebook and Delicious, who didn't, you know, they didn't know that Yahoo was going to kill them off. But it's just Yahoo's problems go back so much further than just like their you know, their current mess with their, you know, CEO or whatever. They just simply have not figured out how to keep up. I honestly think their problem go back to like misconceiving their entire identity from the beginning. Like they have, I don't believe, ever really thought about themselves as a technology company. They've thought about themselves as a media company. And they do the media side pretty well, honestly. Like Yahoo Front Page and Yahoo News and
That's
stocks and all that
is.
Stuff. That's yeah, I mean, it's not the most the best thing in the internet these days, but it certainly is a decent property. But they just it just boggles me that you can like get that many users and that level of interaction and be like, no, we don't actually want it. We just want the database.
Right.
Okay. Well, we'll just sell you the database to keep building the product if that's okay with you.
Do you think Flickr would have been worth what it was worth to Yahoo if it didn't have the users it had? I feel like I'm not totally sure that. I guess. All right. So what you're saying is that they didn't care about the community, which I think is different from what I guess asked. Like you're right. I don't think they cared about the community as much as they cared about the marketability of the size user base. Yada yada yada.
Right. They bought Flickr and then they didn't. They basically let it, it stagnate.
It's a sad story, and it's. I think all of us are really close to Flickr and what it offered and what its promise was, and I think that's why we keep on coming back to this because it's kind of painful.
It is painful.
Yeah. Honestly, it's kind of painful even with Yahoo. Like, I know that Yahoo has not been a fawn of the valley for some time, but like, there is an important sense in which Yahoo sort of symbolizes like the initial, like, sort of frontier spirit of the internet. You know, it's one of the first of the sort of like. There's like a sort of change in Silicon Valley from the like engineering silicon type companies, you know, to the internet companies. Now it sort of really symbolized that. You know, they had like a feeling of, you know, the new internet and everything. And you know, I sort of, you know, get a little bit sad every time.
They were people focused for so long. It's surprising that they are where they are today. Instead of like tech focused.
Right. Yeah. Well, the big problem with that was that Yahoo's founders never really they never really wanted to push the company past its initial kind of service, which is essentially, you know, to serve ads onto searches, the same thing that that Google.
No, I got to disagree with that. Yahoo's focus is in content. They are a content network. They've got Right Media, which is one of the biggest media exchanges around. So they're not into just search ads. They're into ads, display, search, whatever, and email, in fact, because they make deals with email publishers in order to get things inboxed. So I think they're fundamentally a content and ad company, and the search is where they started. But the reason they made Microsoft take over their search is because they're now focusing heavily on their content network and serving advertisements over that network. Like, the Right Media is humongous. Like, you look up RMX, I mean, it's ridiculous. And they're power brokers on the net based on their ability to serve so many ads. The amount of impressions they do is staggering. So I feel like that's where their focus became. It became more on serving ads. So they cared about, like, to Chris's point, they cared about the fact that they had X amount of users. They just didn't care about the community.
Right.
So they were looking for places to serve those ads to users. But I don't think I don't think their scope was ever limited to search, because that portal thing they have, Yahoo Mail, things like that, I think that's kind of where they've grown.
Hardly. I don't think they ever had their own actual search engine. I mean, remember Yahoo was an index. It was like a human done index.
Like DMOZ or something?
I don't remember. I mean, I was too young. All I was sure at the time was I was vaguely aware that it was not a search engine, but an index. I was like, you know, eighth grade at the time. You know, search. Yeah, you're right. They were a portal to the rest of the internet, but they always saw that as being a media thing, something they picked, they curated, they, you know, built up. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Yahoo is certainly not someplace that I would put my stocks.
Now let's move on to a company where you might put your stocks, and that is pushing the boundaries in search, and that is Google. They have a new development called the Knowledge Graph. It's a new search tool that is beginning to roll out starting today. It's meant to help you find search results faster. When you now search for a popular or well-known person, place, or thing, you'll get a box to the right of the results explaining more about your search term. For example, if you search for Frank Lloyd Wright today, and the first link might be to Wikipedia, but now to the right of that result, you'll see some of that Wikipedia or other sourced material information on the right-hand side, including a short summary of who Frank Lloyd Wright was, birth date, etc., related searches. Now, I tried to get this. It hasn't rolled out to me yet, so I haven't seen it on my own search result. But what do you guys think about this? Is this a something that it's to me? It seems like kind of a restatement of Wikipedia, or like having the kind of a Wikipedia mini summary alongside of the regular searches. So I'm not sure entirely what the
value
is.
It seems a little bit like I don't know. I haven't gotten it either, and obviously I don't even use Google. But like it feels a little bit like Wolfram Alpha a little bit. Isn't that sort of the idea, that it's not just about like, you know, searching information, but not just giving me results, but like actually like giving like more specific information about the query?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different, right? Wolfram Alpha is more about computation. So it has this huge database of stuff, and you can actually do something with it. You can almost like program Wolfram Alpha. What this knowledge graph thing seems to be is more about, like, you know, treating the internet as more than just, you know, something for with search terms and words. Objects are things that you can search for now. And what's interesting is that I think we heard in an interview last week too that Bing was trying to do something similar, that it was approaching its search engine as something more than just search terms, like people, objects, the social value of things. All of that is kind of weighing into what would make a good search engine now, because, I mean, the internet itself is changing.
Yeah, this goes along with, I think, what Google was trying to do with their latest update, Penguin, which is to say that they're very focused on content being the center, right? Like, it's about content. It's about building that stuff that people want to see, understand, and advertising will come after that. What I'm I don't know, what do you guys think about the idea that this kind of brings Google – they're aggregating, clearly, right? It's like like WikiQuote, Wikipedia, a couple other things. That's what the Frank Lloyd Wright box was. Is this kind of Google moving toward more direct content from a search, or Google moving toward like HuffPo when it comes to results? Like, what do you guys think? What do you guys think about that as kind of like this new strategy for them to like, you know, get eyeballs, maintain eyeballs, and give results that are curated? They're curating, is what I feel like.
It's not, I mean, it's not really, they're definitely curating in a sense, but it's not really aggregation. It kind of points to what Google always wanted to do, right? Is collect and sort the world's
information.
So it's
organization. That's what you're saying.
Yes, that's how I'm seeing it.
Good, good. All right. I see that too. That's good.
Yeah, they kind of have to. I mean, I'm glad that they're evolving beyond just basics search and getting into that kind of sort of predictive search. So I think that's a
two words for you guys: Encyclopedia Galactica.
There we go.
Yeah.
How about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? What's that?
How about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I'm sure that's what Google has always wanted to be.
Yeah,
like,
right, Encyclopedia.
In 100 years, like, Google's one of those companies I think we'd still be using in some crazy intergalactic or, you know, intersolar capacity. I don't know.
Right.
I'll be using some.
I like the Hitchhiker's Guide, but as I read Douglas Adams, it's clear that he took Encyclopedia Galactica and popularized the Hitchhiker's Guide.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. Chris will be using whatever variant of Linux. is in space. It'll be like the Firefly ship, just rickety,
and it won't quite work quite as well.
But I'll have built it from scratch.
Yes.
And I'll know every segment of it.
Chris is Mao.
Actually, it'll work a lot better. It just will have like all the wires exposed. I mean, that's what Linux is. Like, Linux runs really well. It's just the wires are all. I don't care. I'm like with people who like just don't have a case on their computer. It's like, eh.
Seth Fitzsimmons, Amherst 2002. He talked about how he once had a metal bin with all the components in it, and that was his computer.
Exactly.
I'm getting that Raspberry Pi, by the way, so I should be getting a very similar setup. You know, essentially a computer on a card.
There you go.
What's that?
You know what you're going to run on it yet?
I don't know. I'll probably look
and see. Well, I'm sure he'll call you when it's time.
I might, actually. and our final headline for tonight, Academy Award winning screenwriter Aaron Sorkin will adapt Steve Jobs, the motion picture based on the best-selling biography of the legendary Apple co-founder by award-winning journalist Walter Isaacson. So we've kind of heard rumors that this was going to be the case.
Mm-hmm. This is the Ashton Kutcher flick?
No, this is another.
This is a confusing aspect, right? The Ashton Kutcher movie is an independent movie that will most likely be terrible. This one is...
It'll be terrible because it has Ashton Kutcher?
No, it'll be terrible because I think the very idea of just casting Ashton Kutcher because he happens to look like Steve Jobs seems fundamentally... Like, that seems to be the bad thing because that's how they're starting off that film. This one is more about, let's get a damn good writer to do it. And honestly, like, back when Sorkin was tapped for The Social Network and everybody was making fun of it, I feel like I was one of the few people that was saying, hey, this movie could actually be kind of awesome.
That was a saving grace when it came to their marketing, right? The fact that
there was that
picture.
Like, we didn't know what that movie would create or how that movie would turn out. I think what Sorkin is really good at, and just like how Isaacson, too, is also very good at encapsulating the lives of these great men, right. Sorkin is also really good at just, you know, taking big concepts, especially, like, big American concepts, too. Like, The West Wing was his ode to, like, democracy and his ode to liberalism. Sports Night was just like a fun show that showed like the inner workings of a, you know, how crazy it is to run.
He's an
a late
institutional
night
narrator. To your point. He narrates about institutions, whether it's the institution of government in the West Wing or the institution of like the internet world in this movie and in the other movie. Like, I feel like that's what he focuses on, and that's what's so exciting about it.
His dialogue is great for the techie world too, where we're all like crazy fast talkers and. Maybe too witty for our own good sometimes. So it's a good fit. Yeah.
Also, I mean, another thing that Sorkin does well is dynamic personalities. And I think that, I mean, you've seen it with Mark Zuckerberg and no one, that was like the stepping stone to the inevitable, to this Steve Jobs, which is who's got to be probably one of the most dynamic personalities in the tech world, period. And to put Aaron Sorkin on the case on this is just it is like you said, Devendra's the perfect fit.
I just want there to be a line where he's like, "If you had invented Apple, then you would have invented Apple."
I just hope that there's no girl.
There was girls in.
There were girls.
I know. I'm just saying that, like, the girl in The Social Network was disappointing. It's sort of like,
you know,
the girl
you know what? I can already tell you what this movie is going to be. You know how Social Network.
Misogynist.
Well, but you know how Social Network the premise of Social Network was that the foundation for this social network sprung out of. The
Harbor Connection kind of
the
thing?
No of the personality conflicts that he was having with this girl that he was dating at the time.
That's what was so disappointing about it.
Well, no, I think that was a great approach to it.
It was a narrative conceit, but it was not true to life. So that's what annoyed me about The Social Network.
That's what's annoying. Yeah,
but as a narrative conceit, I thought it was brilliant.
Sorry, we're cross talking. Yeah. Go ahead.
and I think that that I can already see what's going to happen here is Aaron Sorkin's going to have kind of all of the conflict of Steve Jobs's personality surround around this the conflict that he had with his first wife and the daughter that he had to that he basically abandoned, and the whole abandonment issues with his own.
Why would you want to? Like, I mean, I feel like. It just seems that that's not, like, the story, I hope, is more nuanced than I had a problem with a girl and I'm going to make the world different because of it. I mean,
that'll be the subtext.
That's not a good story. I mean, that's an old story and it's a classic story.
Yeah.
That's not new and exciting and it's not...
It's Helen of Troy, you know?
Yeah, it's Helen of Troy. Like, let's get something that actually is about... Can we have a man who's motivated not by vagina or like the lack of vagina or some other thing like that? Can we have a man who's motivated by truly wanting to move the world in a different direction based on what he sees in his brainchild and being able to express that possibly, you know, well, in some cases not so well, in some cases make enemies because of it, but not predicated on some girl. Like,
but you know what? If you read the book, you'll see. Did you read the book?
I did not read the book. It's very
apparent that regardless of what else was going on in Steve Jobs' life, that was the biggest unresolved conflict in his life.
Actually, the issues with women and with the women in Steve Jobs' life are far more fitting for a Steve Jobs movie than it was.
Okay, great. I just feel like when you read The Accidental Billionaires, which I had to read, right. It was just like Sorkin was like, oh, I'll just put a girl in and then I'll be an easy way to tell. And I get it. You only have 2 hours to tell a story. Fine. If you got to make a crutch, then make a crutch. But I guess saying from the last movie I saw, and the lack of girlness, I mean, and the preponderance of girlness in order to be a catalyst for changing, I would hope that we could get something a little bit more nuanced about a man and his drive. Now, also, Steve Jobs was adopted, and I'm sure that has something to do with what drives him and things like that. So that to me would be more interesting than some romantic issue.
That's going to be, like, the thing about it, though, is I feel for The Social Network, it's almost as if Sorkin had to, like, create the drama. Because
he's so, yeah.
Well, potentially because, like, I don't think the actual story of it, or at least what compelled Zuckerberg to do it, it may not have been too interesting, like, dramatically. So he had to, like, come up with this whole conceit to figure that all out. Steve Jobs' life is, I think, just on the surface level, like, yeah, far more interesting.
It's three times. It's interesting because it's three times as long, right?
Zuckerberg. Yeah,
it's also just very unique. I think.
Yeah.
I guess I want to, and this is getting more into film criticism than the actual. But I think one thing that Sorkin does well in these movies, and why I'm interested in this, is like I think he realizes that like the value of like he's not doing a documentary. Like the point of watching a movie about Jobs or Zuckerberg is like the same as like why people like, you know, listen to performances of like Richard III or whatever. I mean, like Richard III was a real dude, but like not like Shakespeare wrote him. Like but the point doesn't matter. Like Shakespeare took real historical figures and figured out how to write
stories. But he was writing them for idiots. Sorkin writes for smart people. That's the difference. Like I studied Shakespeare. I studied Shakespeare, the historiography around Shakespeare. Like this is like what I had to study at Amherst where I went. Like he had to write for the throng. Aaron Sorkin didn't do that. I mean, obviously there are lots of people who watch the show, but he's more like a Joss Whedon who's like, I'm going to write about something that's actually meaningful, and I want an intelligent audience to pick up on this. I don't need the crossover as much because I think that I'll be able to express it in a way where I'll get advocates, and those advocates will move the work.
But he does that because he realizes that, like, even me, like in the tech scene doing a startup, like, you know, I love The Social Network as a movie, not because I think it's an accurate portrayal of Zuckerberg, because I think it captures something about what it means to be passionate about something and what it means to have an idea and what it means to build and execute, and also what it means about what to give up things, you know, that like, you know, there are sacrifices and the mistakes that are made by the Zuckerberg character in that movie, you know, that, you know, are very real to him and that he does, you know, struggle through. And I think that that's a, you know, a valuable story to be told, regardless of the fact that that's true or not. And I think that all of Sorkin's work sort of fits into that. And I'm hoping that, you know, Jobs is a larger than life figure, and hopefully there'll be some very good documentaries made about his life. But I think with Sorkin behind it, it's more about like Jobs, the guy that symbolized everything to everybody. And
so basically, I'm hearing that with a dramatization, you just can't hope for any realism. It's got to be a girl. It's got to be whatever because it's a dramatization.
Well, it doesn't have to be. I think the girl thing, or at least the way he positioned that in The Social Network, was probably the movie's biggest problem, just because it did feel weak. So, but I still love the movie. So I don't know.
Yeah, the soundtrack. I hope that somebody awesome does the soundtrack. Probably won't be Trent Reznor again.
Well, it depends on the way.
Like, if it's Fincher again.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a director sorted yet for this, but I'm sure everybody wants Fincher to try and do it.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. A 3-hour-long Steve Jobs movie by David Fincher.
They could make it 5.5 hours long. We'd watch it.
David Fincher.
I would watch the shit out of it.
Wait, David Fincher, the guy who did
watch
like
the shit out of it. That's disgusting. Okay.
Didn't David Fincher do
Fight Club? He did.
Did you do Mulholland Drive, or am I thinking it was?
No,
that's David Lynch.
David Lynch. I was gonna like that would be a bizarre version of
Alien 3. David Fincher did Alien 3.
I would watch that too.
I would not.
All right, let's take a break here. Before we do, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. which is audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook plus a free, and I think I can officially say it now, 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker. And this is the story of Kevin Mitnick, who was at the time was the most elusive computer break-in artist in history. He accessed computers and networks at the world's biggest companies, and however fast the authorities were, Mitnick was faster. But as the FBI's net began to tighten, Kevin went on the run, engaging in an increasingly sophisticated cat-and-mouse game that led through false identities, a host of cities, plenty of close shaves, and to an ultimate showdown with the feds, who would stop at nothing to bring him down. And spoilers, they actually caught him and he went to jail.
Of course they caught him. Didn't he like become a white hat for them?
Well, after he got out of jail, he started his own consulting security firm. And now he's writing books. And
I feel like he got out a little early because he did some work because of like white hat stuff. But I got to read it.
Maybe you're right. This book is written by Kevin Mitnick with William L. Simon and narrated by Ray Porter. And if I'm not mistaken, William L. Simon's the guy that wrote that. No, I'm sorry. He wrote a couple of Steve Jobs books as well. The Steve Jobs Way, iLeadership for a New Generation, and Icon Steve Jobs. That's where I know that guy's name from. So that book, or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours for free. But also the 30-day trial, I think, is more important thing here to check out their service. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. And if you've never joined Audible before, that's the perfect link to go to because it helps our show out as well. So please do that. And let's take a little break here. We're going to listen to a little music. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some new changes at Facebook and whether or not those changes are going to have an impact on their IPO and basically the future of their company. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech, in social media, and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar, Dwayne DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor. And let's talk about some new things going on at Facebook. Facebook unveiled a new hub for consumers to find games and other apps on the social network, including its first storefront for selling paid apps. The new App Center, which Facebook said will launch in the next few weeks, comes as the company is preparing an IPO that would value the company between $77 billion and $96 billion. Consumers will need to use Facebook credits, the company's payment system, to purchase the apps, and Facebook will take a 30% cut of the revenue, as it does with in-app purchases. The App Center will showcase apps based on the quality scores that users give apps and other data Facebook collects, such as how often and how long people use apps. Each user will see a different customized version of the App Center rather than the one standard version of the App Center. So, I mean, basically they're following the iTunes business model here with this.
Yeah. I have one caveat. I think Facebook changed some IPO numbers. It might hit $105 billion.
Which is weird because also this week, you know, there have been talks about how like their interaction online is way down, so they might have lower profit margins, and like, you know, there's a story about GM pulling their account from Facebook.
Yeah, we're
going
to get into that puppy in a moment too.
It's just sort of funny. We're like, oh, we're going to adjust those numbers up.
Well, the adjusting of the numbers up was before these debacles.
But presumably, they knew about them. I mean, maybe not the GM one, but you know, they. It's not like the numbers on the mobile or something just sort of comes out after, you know, out of nowhere, especially if you are Facebook.
Anyway. You know, it's true. It's true. You're right. There's something a little weird about this. But yeah, it's so when it comes to this app store, I mean, I'm excited. Apple hasn't really done a lot to like move the ball forward in terms of app discovery. I'm not the biggest fan of this idea that everything is unique. So that when I log in, it's different for me than it is for my friend.
But I'm sure there will still be like leaderboards.
There, yeah, the paradigm will be the same. But personalized stuff always gets me because, you know, Chris, DeVinci, and I, we come from a background of having to help people on the computer. So the idea that you log in and the shit is different is just kind of like,
What to do? I mean, Apple bought Chomp, right? So that's essentially... A future app store will have something similar to Chomp's app discovery, and that's going to compete directly with this. This seems like a Hail Mary pass by Facebook.
You think
it's
so?
Like, hey, we need something in mobile. We got apps. There are apps in mobile.
I think they're building up. I think they're doing the opposite of what Google did. Google had the problem. They went into mobile without any infrastructure to support mobile. They just like started making a phone, and they were like, oh, well, you know, here's the phone. They didn't have payment processing systems. They didn't have a store. Like, they had no way to serve. I think Facebook is going at it the opposite way. I don't know what their ultimate plan is, but I think they're trying to build up the infrastructure of having a payment processing platform, having, you know, a marketplace, and having users before they come out with whatever their big mobile solution is. Because I'm sure Facebook is going to do this. You don't go just spending $1 billion in a company like because you feel like it one day. I think Facebook has a mobile plan.
Strategy, yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to see it.
And that's what they explicitly said that. They explicitly said that Instagram was purchased not to integrate into Facebook, but because their team understands mobile in a way that Facebook doesn't. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you guys, but I'm not happy with the Facebook app for the iPhone. I mean, it's better than the Facebook app for the BlackBerry. It's better than the Facebook app for the Android.
It's one of the worst apps on the App Store, though. I mean, it freezes all the time, and it like doesn't load.
Oh my gosh!
It takes forever to get responses. Yeah, it's an awful experience.
I thought it was just me.
No.
Well, they also bought Lightbox. Do you guys know what Lightbox is? It was like the Instagram for Android before Instagram actually hit Android. So they bought Lightbox just for the team because they need good mobile developers. So
this is your word, acqui-hire.
Acqui-hire.
Yep, it's the new thing in the valley.
Yeah.
Basically, just a really expensive resume that you paid a lot for.
Yeah, I feel like, okay, so like, you know, DaVinci thinks this is a Hail Mary. Chris thinks this is a secret part of a more clandestine super plan. I think...
Well, you put it that way.
I don't know exactly, right?
Wouldn't they have done this sooner? To me, it's like, if this was truly significant, I'm not sure why it took Facebook so long. Because it doesn't take a genius to realize that in the mobile space, right, there's a few things you can monetize. You know, you could advertise.
Yeah.
You can monetize like how people are accessing your product, or you can monetize like app recommendations or something related
app
to
app downloads.
Apps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Facebook had the infrastructure for that forever, so I'm not sure, like, what's the deal here? Like, why did it take so long?
Well, there's a lot of advertising here that I think is more okay. So Facebook, let's imagine that Facebook is focused on magnetic content when it comes to advertising. So, you know, GM spent $40 million on Facebook last year or something like that, and they only $10 million was actually an ad buy because people they're using like, you know, different things on Facebook, their fan page, driving users to register, getting likes, things like that. That's how much money they're spending on Facebook, even if they're not spending it with Facebook. Another big thing in this space is mobile app downloads. So you've got like Graystripe and a couple other vendors out there, and they're working with advertisers being Coca-Cola, GM, whatever, to have users download their app, and they get paid on the app download. There's no reason why Facebook wouldn't want to talk to those advertisers and get a piece of that change too, right? Because everybody's on our thing. Everybody has a smartphone. If you can come here and we can help figure out the best app for you, then we can get some money, and we can get some money, and we can get you engaged on our platform more, and you're gonna find those apps that you want. So for us, it's a win-win-win. Win for the advertiser because the right kind of people are gonna discover the right kind of apps. Win for the user because they're gonna discover the right kind of apps. Win for Facebook because that costs money. So I think that Dominguez is right in that this is a. It's not a super highfalutin concept. Mm-hmm. It's not like a really hard one to get to. But I think it was probably difficult for them to find a way to implement it correctly. App discovery doesn't seem like an easy thing.
No, definitely not. I mean, Apple doesn't do a terribly good job with it. They had to purchase a company to find their
way. Apple never had the data, right? What Chomp had was like the way that app worked is that, you know, you would start using it and it would get better because like, oh, these are the apps you like on your system. As you bought new things, it was able to do it in a better way, better than what the App Store Genius or whatever thing Apple had. They had the better technology for it. Maybe Facebook didn't have that initial technology, but there were ways to do this, especially like something as big as Facebook. Like developers would fight each other to feature their app on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Like that, it doesn't even need personalization. People would it could just be a screen that Facebook.
Yeah, we got to keep in mind Facebook as a company is still pretty small. Like they only have like a few, I think maybe a few thousand people total, and even of those, like not the majority of them are programmers. I mean, they have a lot of sales and. You know, marketing people too. So like, you know, they have a limited number of resources. And I guess, I mean, it's easy to think about like, you know, Google and Facebook as just being able to, you know, being capable of anything because of their engineering talent. But like when you have a company of that size, like it takes a lot of engineering talent to just keep it going. Like, you know, it's like you have to, and because of the size, it takes that much more to iterate, you know, and put something up. Like, you know, I can, you know, throw up something in a weekend EC2 instance and, you know, see if anybody likes it. You know, Google has to be prepared for, you know, 30 million people on the first day, which means they have to have an entire like ops team, you know,
an army
server. Yeah, they have a whole army to do like literally the smallest, you know, demo that they want to do. And that, you know, and Facebook, you know, is in a similar situation, you know, smaller, but still like it's easy to think like, oh, because they have all these engineers, it's easy for them to do anything, but it takes something for them to, you know, to actually iterate. They're big ships. Mm-hmm. They're more like battleships than old speedboats.
All right. Let's move on here. Microsoft is making yet another attempt to deeply integrate Facebook into its Bing search. And we briefly mentioned this a little earlier in the headlines. As a way to gain some ground on arch rival Google, Bing Search's new look features a three-column design. The largest column, which covers the left half of the page, features the familiar 10 blue links that users have come to expect from web search. The center column is something Microsoft is calling Snapshot. There, Bing offers information and services related to specific searches, giving users the ability to take actions directly from search results. But the column that Microsoft believes will win over new users is the one on the right that features Facebook friends. Microsoft engineers have created technology to index data from Facebook and then map it to individual users' search queries. And it only works, obviously, when users are signed into Facebook. Once logged in, the column on the right finds friends that might know something about a specific query, then lets users ask those friends for guidance. Search for Seattle restaurants, for example, will populate the top section of the column under the heading Friends Who Might Know with Facebook pals who live in Seattle. At the top of the list will be those who have liked particular Seattle restaurants in Facebook. And what do you guys think about this approach to search, is having it hyper-personalized like this? Isn't this like what search is supposed to be? Or no?
Isn't this what Google's doing that we were complaining about? Like just making it super personal again? I don't know. I saw it. It sounds like they're doing the same thing Google's doing with Search Plus Your World, except they're using – so they're probably more likely to be relevant because they're using your actual like social data rather than Google Plus pretend social data. But
yeah, I think this is kind of like that, except for think about it this way. Less than the whole Search Your World, it's more like search with Google Plus results, except it's Microsoft and Facebook teaming up against Google. So it's search with Facebook results. So it's social – focused search. It's a search that taps into your social graph in order to find the best thing for you, not social search that taps into like that sort of history graph thing that the current thing is doing. So this is a catch up, I think, to the couple weeks ago announcement and implementation, a couple months ago announcement and implementation of Google Plus search.
Yeah, I'm trying it right now, and I must have something blocked because I'm logged into Facebook and I'm not seeing that far right panel, so I can't say that I can't judge this experience. I think it's a good idea on the surface. It's just
as long as you can turn it off.
Don't go to Bing.
I can't even turn it on. So
I like Bing. I gotta say, when I do open web research, I will use both Google and Bing to find out what I need to look for. I find Bing's results are they're significantly different enough and useful enough to make yourself, you know, I can't hang on Bing.
Did anybody else read Farhad Manju's article on going off Google for a week? He had an article, I think it was this past week or last week on it. He basically did a test where he just simply stopped using Google for a week and used Bing instead. Uh-huh. And his overall response was, he's like, you know, I didn't notice it after like 2 days. It was just same story. He's like, you know, this is the big secret about search. Like, everyone thinks Google's this huge monopoly and, oh my gosh, there's nothing else. But you know what? Like, you can swap it out for something else and, you won't know.
Search is a commodity service.
It really is. It's kind of amazing that they've managed to keep a monopoly on it, but they have.
Well, that has to do with their position in the marketplace back in like 1999 and 2000, when they were delivering results that were far and away better than anybody else out there. And then, you know, after that was said and done, they were so good that they started getting like a sort of social buzz, like the word of mouth hit it. Because it wasn't that Google did a lot of advertising on TV. It was word of mouth. Use Google. What is Google? I don't know. It's a funny word. You know, just like Yahoo's a funny word. But since Google's a kind of a, you know, there's no actual word that's Google. I mean, you can have a Google, that's a number, but that's spelled differently. People started using it as the verb, and it caught on, and it became part of pop culture the same way Madonna's part of pop culture, or Thermos, or Kleenex or whatever. So I think that's the strength that they have. That's what keeps them in the – that's a lot of what keeps them in the lead. And then they're smart enough to continually release – Halo type products and projects and press releases and so on and so forth. Whereas Bing is clearly like a stepdaughter of Microsoft. You know, like they had Microsoft Search, MSN, all that other stuff, Ad Center. Mm-hmm. And they eventually were like, okay, we're going to rebrand it as Bing, kind of to be its own thing, because the thing that Google has that Microsoft doesn't when it comes to search is that Google is search. Their identity is focused around search. And I'm not going to go for something that's necessarily that seems like it's some other company's second tier product and not their marquee product. And I think that's what Google has going for it. Like it has a lot to do with the way they've been able to position themselves in the marketplace socially, in addition to like technically.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to our last subtopic here on the Facebook thing. And I think this is probably one of the biggest issues here, and the one with the potential for the most controversy, and that is General Motors has decided to pull its advertising campaigns from Facebook, saying that their paid ads have had little effect on customers. The move comes just days ahead of Facebook's IPO, which is coming this Friday. So basically, by the time you hear this podcast on MP3. Facebook will have launched their IPO. GM's announcement adds fodder to critics who say that Facebook and other tech sites may be overvalued. More than 50% of Facebook users say they never click on Facebook's sponsored ads, according to a recent poll. In addition, only 12% of respondents say they feel comfortable making purchases over Facebook, begging the question of how the social network can be effectively monetized. Is this
do you guys think that people don't click, that people actually, I mean, all right. Do you think that when it comes to the survey respondents, some of them may not know they're clicking on ads? Because you'll see things like sponsored stories and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. That is true with Facebook. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't – the Facebook ads don't feel like ads. Like, it honestly took me a while to realize that, you know, a lot – because a lot of times they just redirect you back within Facebook. It's like it's not taking you to an external site. Like, you click on Coca-Cola's ad on Facebook, it'll bring you to the Coca-Cola page there. That's – I mean, yeah, I do worry about the procedural aspects of a survey like this, you know, because I also, you know, note that like one of the things that Facebook has sort of proven about social networks that's kind of amazing is that people don't really know what they want. I mean, like every time Facebook runs out some new big feature and overhaul, people hate it for like 3 months and then they keep using it, you know? And that's sort of like a breakthrough when it comes to like customer design. Like most companies don't operate on the principle of we're going to do something that our users are going to hate and then they're going to come back because they still love us. And that's, I don't know. It makes me wonder about taking, you know, with a grain of salt. You know, if you had said to, you know, a couple years ago, like, oh, you know, do you want a news feed in Facebook? What would you think if all your activity on Facebook was advertised to everyone else? People would be like, oh, this is terrible. But now it's central to what Facebook is.
Yeah.
So I just feel like that's something to hop over when it thinks to just think about when we think about this GM thing. On the other hand, I mean, I think we'd all agree that you're not on Facebook for the ads.
Yeah, no, like, there is the intent.
The content but I mean, is so compelling because it's all your friends.
When part of their
kind of don't notice
their business model is going to be based upon ad sales, is this like a bellwether event? Is this a harmonger of doom
it's
for them?
Certainly awful timing. If you're an advertiser like GM just got out of bankruptcy. They just had to buy their shares back from the U.S. government. And part of the reason that they were able to do that was because they're like the third largest advertiser in the United States right now. They spent a lot of the money they had on advertising their products, discounting their products, promoting their products, getting word of mouth out there, doing a lot of different types of buys and a lot of different types of media. And if they're looking at Facebook with 950 million users or whatever it has now, and they're saying, look, I couldn't move the needle on you. That does say mm-hmm. something. It says that, you know, Facebook, who's traditionally said, you know, we're not here to make money. We make money so we can make a great product, might have something to say. But from what I've read, the Facebook people have been like, well, GM didn't do all that it could do to exploit our platform. When it comes to the paid ads, the way it could. So it's not a great response from Facebook. I think we'd all agree that's kind of, why would you say that? but it definitely shows that there's no love lost. And it's definitely a big deal that right before your IPO, one of the biggest advertisers in like the most powerful country in the world, the richest country in the world, right. is not interested in advertising on your platform.
Yeah.
It's definitely bad news. But I think there's more to this story that needs to come out.
Well, especially because honestly, like, you know, Google really did well with the like super targeted hyper local advertising, you know, like Google by and large doesn't advertise for big accounts like GM, you know, like they advertise for your local barbershop, like all the people who basically couldn't advertise before outside of the phone book, Google like really empowered to be able to, you know, leverage advertising for like good results. Facebook is much more about brand advertising. Like that's really what it does really well because it's not capturing intent, but it is capturing identity. So if you want to identify yourself with a brand or something, that's perfect for, you know, for what Facebook is about. So I think it's a rough sign for Facebook that a big brand like this, which is arguably, you know, at the core of what they provide to advertisers is saying, you know what, like at the end of the day, it doesn't do anything. But at the same time, you know, maybe their problem is, you know, in the world of Google, like you can actually measure that now. You can actually, like, it used to be you just like threw an ad up on you know, TV and you're like, well, I hope that that'll drive some you know, car sales, and you just don't know. Whereas now, you know, advertisers can actually measure that and be like, wait a minute, this isn't really doing anything for us. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens if they can, you know, maybe they'll come out with something and it'll just be like, well, you know what, you got to go with us because we're the network where all the people are, and there's just no other alternative.
It does seem a little short-sighted considering a lot of people basically live on Facebook. I mean, it is their walled garden, and to pull out of that you know, to remove your visibility from that walled garden seems a little short-sighted, but I think it's difficult to tell right now until, I mean, once they go public, I think we'll be a little clearer on how, and once they go public and once they start reaching out, once marketers start reaching out through Facebook on a exponential scale, I think it'll be easier to tell the impact that it has as a marketing device.
Yeah, no, it'll be once we get to see some actual sales number two, I think is where this will get really, you actually be able to figure out like who is making money. For all we know, there's some, you know, no name company out there that's killing it on Facebook. We just have no idea.
All right,
Facebook should drop that knowledge. They should say, "Hey, look, here are people who are doing really well."
I think they probably will once their business relies on it. You know, coming
out. I mean, if GM's spending money, that means other people are spending money. If someone's doing well, I mean, like my ads company is spending money on Facebook, but people are spending money. The platform, it's not gonna, like, it might get a little bigger when they IPO, but there's no restriction. You can spend money on Facebook. You as an individual can, and I just feel like it's a place where advertisers are already going. So if they have success stories, now is the time to publish them before the IPO.
Let's take a little break here. When we come, we're going to take a little bit of listen to some music. And when we come back, we're going to ask the question whether should people bother learning to code or not. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar, Duane DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor. And Chris, now you read a little bit about this learn to code, don't learn to code controversy going on in the web. Now, it kind of started with a kind of public push amongst a lot of people to get people to learn to code. With the idea that it's going to be important in the years to come, and out of that came a response from Jeff Atwood over at Coding Horror.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Jeff Atwood is also, I should mention, the one of the founders of Stack Overflow, the Stack Exchange Network, which is a absolutely huge question and answer network for technical questions. Basically the question and answer site on the web. I think it has significantly bigger traffic than Quora. I personally think this probably started somewhat with the revelations that the trial, the Google Oracle trial judge had actually taught himself to code. It wasn't clear to me if that was recent or if he had done that a while ago, but you know, he's like, oh, I've actually learned to code and I'm going to, you know, bring this on to, you know, the, the trial, and I think there's been a lot of push from places like Code Academy, and I think Udemy is doing it too, and there's a couple of other places online, you know, really pushing this whole like teach yourself to code sort of thing. I think this comes out of a realization, you know, that for a lot of programmers who are sort of in their 30s, maybe even going to 40s now, you know, they grew up with computers where like you got DOS and Quick Basic, and you know, you could spend like $100 on, you know, pre-made software, or you could, you know, come up with something yourself that did what you needed to do. And I think people are realizing that, you know, the modern computers are not like that. Like, people grow up having absolutely no idea what, you know, what is going on underneath the computer. And I think there's a push to go against that. So Jeff Atwood's basic point was, look, like, the world doesn't need more bad coders. He had a great quote on there or something. He's like, it assumes that more code in the world is an inherently desirable thing. In my 30-year career as a programmer, I have found this not to be the case. Should you learn to write to code? No, I can't get behind that. You should learn to write as little code as possible, ideally none. which is – honestly, it's a good point. Like, I remember in my high school like CS course, you know, we had some assignment, and it was one of the bigger end of the year assignments, and two of my friends were boasting about how large their code base was. One guy was like, "Well, I have 15,000 lines in my final project," and the next guy was like, "I've got 20,000 lines in mine," and I was like, "Guys, mine does it in like 1,500 lines, and it did all the extra credit ones too. More code does not make it a better program. It makes it a worse program."
Unless you're Microsoft.
Unless you're Microsoft, yeah. I think he's got some good points in here. You know, like code, especially when it's doing things that other things are built on top of, you know, code matters. Like, and I think that's an important thing to be reminded about. Like, it's all fun and it's good to code, but it does matter. It really does run the world. And one of the big problems, you know, that all of us who've worked in IT have seen is that there's a great deal of extremely central business software and workflow essential software out there that's just abysmal. And that is not helping anyone in the world when that stuff is out there. I don't know. It led to a fairly big debate on Hacker News. I took a screenshot at one point because the top three ones were like, learn to code, don't learn to code, why you should learn to code, and just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any thoughts on this? I don't want to get too off on this.
I do. Like, I think his broader point, right, is that coding is not really an essential skill. Like, what we really need in the world are people who know how to read well and who know how, you know, who can actually do critical thinking and can communicate well.
Deep critical thinking is more important than like a bad skill.
Exactly. And I'm not telling people like not to code. Like, definitely we should all explore fun and new projects like Code Academy. Go for it. If you can build something really cool and if you end up really enjoying it, you know, good for you. That doesn't make you a programmer, certainly. I think I'm also coming at this from life experience. You know, all throughout high school, I thought I was going to go to college and learn to be a computer programmer, right? I did some HTML during high school. I made nice, fun web pages. And then I got to college and I learned that I hated coding. And that, like, that was a pretty big revelation to me because it meant I couldn't or I didn't want to major in computer science. Right. And kind of shifted my life in a whole other direction. And coding is just one of those things. You can totally enjoy technology and computers without learning how to code. Actually, moving forward, we need people who can actually think critically about how technology works and how it affects our lives more than, you know, the people that actually build it. Although, if you look at New York right now, like, everybody's, you know, crying for engineers.
I think a lot of this comes out of, like, you know, if you put, like, anything related to developer or engineer on your LinkedIn profile, you will get at least one message a week, probably more like one a
day.
That's
probably what the CEO of Yahoo
you know?
Yeah.
He's like,
yeah,
I need a job, man.
Like, I can't even tell you the number of just, like, ignored random, you know, things that I have people coming at me just simply because I say that I'm a programmer. You know, I would honestly put it something like music. I think music is a good analogy for the value and yet non-value of music. Like, honestly, we don't need more
karaoke
singing. Exactly. And that's exactly what the vast majority of people's, you know, programming is going to be like. It's going to be the programming equivalent of karaoke. Or the equivalent of like middle school band or high school band, you know, like that. Basically, the audience,
the lack of professionalism is junk. Like, just because you can read it, just because you know a little bit about it, it's sort of the classic adage that like a little knowledge is worse than no knowledge at all.
Yeah.
Certain things.
But at the same time, I would argue that there's still value in that. Like, I think that music is an important skill to learn. It's not a necessary skill, but I think it's an important skill for some people because it changes the way that you think. Like, you're not going to become a great programmer, or it's necessarily going to make you a better person, but you're going to understand an important part of our culture and be able to think in a better way because of that. Like, you know, Jeff says, you know, is this going to make Bloomberg a better mayor because he learns how to code? It's like, no, it's not going to make him a better mayor, but neither is – and I wouldn't criticize him if he says, you know what, I'm going to learn the harmonica this year. I'm like, great. Yeah. Good for you, Michael Bloomberg. Like,
but
I think there's
also something to be said. I mean, I feel like the fundamental thing of what he's saying is that coding is a way of life for this man. It's not something he picked up in order to kind of know better how to deal with some obscure, strange copyright virtual machine case. It's a way that he thinks already, and it's because he's dedicated his life to getting it done. And to think that someone, even a smart person like a judge, could hop in and teach himself how to code and kind of – it's not the most complete – like, it is a very autodidactic skill, but it's not the kind of thing that you jump into and then claim expertise at. Because there's a lot of convention and society associated with it, even though it is in many ways a free form kind of thing. There are conventions, there are rules, there's focus, syntax is important. You know, there's it's almost as if like if in 45 years we saw like schools coming out with like certified programmers, like how you have a lawyer or a doctor, I wouldn't be surprised because of all the convention that begins to come around. The way, you know, thinking is around it. So I think that, you know, when he says don't learn to code, from what I've read, it's like don't learn to code as a means to just like, you know, trying to talk about something. Learn to code if you're going to focus on coding and getting something done right, if you want to build something, that kind of thing. And if you, and to Dominguez's point, if you can have access to coders and use your critical thinking in order to solve a real like business problem or personal problem or society problem, then like more power to you. I think for a lot of people though, the impetus to learn how to code is there's a certain freedom in understanding that you don't need somebody else to get something done on a machine. And yeah. I think that's kind of where the exciting part is. And I don't know. What do you think about that? Andy Devinger, what do you guys
think? I generally agree. I mean, I think that like for me, the only time I've ever had any sort of motivation to want to learn to code is when I'm building something and I understand that I need at some point to code something to get this to work, and I don't want to have to pay somebody. So at times like that, I'm like desperately, I need to learn how to do this myself so I can do it myself exactly the way I want to do it and not be beholding to the way somebody else has done it, has coded it.
Right, because I'm not going to tell – I might know a little bit about coding, but I'm not going to tell Chris about coding because Chris is the expert. Chris is advertising because I he's gonna be like, I know a little bit about advertising, but he's not gonna claim that kind of expertise. And this judge is kind of claiming, oh, I know this, I got this, man.
Yeah, well, one of the judges in that place where like they know just enough to be dangerous, and that is one problem you get now is there is enough like introductory tutorials. It's this funny thing, like it's super easy to learn the basics of coding these days, but like any tutorial out there, even the most full fledged ones, like really like skip over all the things that make coding hard, like all the like all the things that actually like are why, you know, engineers in the Valley get paid what they do, and why they're so hard to get, because there's just not that many people who can learn the code. I don't know. I'm honestly have very mixed feelings about this whole thing, and I didn't comment on it until now because I have mixed feelings. You know, on the one hand, I totally understand all the things Jeff has coming from, you know, from it. At the same time, like, I'm here because I did teach myself to code. I mean, I took two CS courses, one in high school and one in college. And the college one was on hardware design, so it didn't even affect my programming abilities. Like, I'm literally 100% self-taught, and I love it. It's, like, seriously probably my number one passion. So on the one hand, I'm sort of like, no, people should do it. People should, like, just learn. It's fun. How could you not like it? And at the same time, you know, I understand that, you know, I think a lot of people are coming to it for the wrong reasons. Like, it is a skill. It is a technical skill set. You know, we don't encourage people to go into civil engineering because it's fun. Bridges need to stand up at the same time. Yeah, plumbing, electrical engineering, like cars, like, you know, why do we think that you can just, you know, pick this up? At the same time, like, I think there is something behind the people who are pushing for coding too, because you know what? Like, a lot of people don't get into it because they think, oh, you know, that's hard for smart people, you know, for people with, you know, like the Zuckerberg in the social network, not the real Zuckerberg, you know, the one with the social network who's like borderline Asperger's, you know, doesn't have any friends. I have friends. I can't be a coder. And I think that's something that we need to fight against, but we need to not go the opposite direction. And, you know, people should pursue their actual dreams, not what somebody else manufactures for them because it suits their business purposes.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I like how you put it, Chris. Yeah. And also, like, what we were also seeing for a long time is that like women were sort of being steered away from programming and computer science as well. Like, I think the discussions really helped kind of open the door to at least for more girls to say, hey, this is actually something that I could do, even if maybe none of my friends is doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other thing which really needs to be addressed really probably separately. And I think I'm part of the thing pushed behind this, you know, but I don't know. The nerd community needs to realize that just because they're nerds and they were marginalized doesn't mean that they're automatically like good on all the other marginalized groups in society.
Yeah. For sure. Have you guys seen the new 21 Jump Street film, because that's actually a hilarious plot point.
Really?
I have not.
It's an amazing movie, guys. Just super tangent. The movie is actually awesome.
I've got it on my...
Really? Is it going to ruin my... Because my feeling of the original 21 Jump Street was that it was the coolest thing I ever saw. Ever.
This is a comedy.
You're kidding, right?
I think you'll be pleased, even you, Dwayne.
Can I pretend it's named something else?
No.
I do have it on my lineup of things to watch, and I will be watching it at this as soon as I get some break downtime. So for sure. Is that should we wrap this up? Unless anybody else has something.
Yeah, man, Chris just dropped the most uplifting idea. Yeah. You know? It was good shit.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap it up. I think it's best to end on a high note here. So let me start around the table here with you, Devendra. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the drill down?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about technology at VentureBeat.com. I podcast about movies and TV at SlashFilm.com. I also do a Legend of Korra podcast at RepublicCityDispatch.com.
All right. And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
Find me at twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. For some reason, my Twitter's been blowing up too. I don't know.
Oh, nice. I hope it's this corona effect from the show.
Yeah, hopefully. You can also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD and gplus.to/DwayneD. I'm also still hammering away at this completely cloud-based version of DwayneD.net, which is not... the idea is that I don't have to maintain anything, and I still want what I want, but that doesn't always happen when you don't have to maintain anything. So we're working on it.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the drill down?
Well, you can find most of the articles that I think are pretty cool on my Twitter feed at Chris Bernor, CHRISBORNOR. And then my more long-form stuff I do at chrisbernor.com, my blog. And then you can also subscribe to the Startup Digest reading list, which comes out every Friday, and it's our list of what we think are the most important startup-related articles. And I co-curate that with Chris McCann.
Cool. Very nice. You can find me on MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to, MrBabyMan, Facebook.com, MrBabyMan. Just Google MrBabyMan or Bing it if you like, and maybe you'll find me there on the sidebar amongst your Facebook friends. Check out the past episodes of The Drill Down. as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network. On geeksofdoom.com, you could subscribe to us on iTunes by going straight to Geeks of Doom, and we're right there in the upper right-hand column of the site for that link. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about, or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish. And let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful The Drill Down audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.